Okay, ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to the last session this morning. We have Ken Longnecker, Christine Schreyer, and also John Wagner on Conservation Squared, the relationship between power language conservation and marine conservation in coastal PNG. Ken.
All right, thanks very much. Today I'm going to tell you a story about the confluence of a couple of research projects in a very remote area of Papua New Guinea, and ultimately how this interaction helped strengthen each of the programs and benefited the local communities where we were working. I want to make clear right now that I am not a linguist, so please forgive me if I misuse some terms or if I take a long-winded approach to explaining something that could be expressed very succinctly if I knew your jargon. Also, I don't have the linguist's facility with non-English sounds, so every now and then I'm going to have to call on my co-presenter, Christine, for backup when it comes to some pronunciations. Okay. We're going to take you to Papua New Guinea. This is an island just to the north of Australia. Papua New Guinea is on the eastern half of this island. It's a very linguistically diverse area. The total land area of this country is roughly the same size as the state of California, yet there are over 800 distinct vernacular languages there. How'd I do? Most people are multilingual, though. English is the language of commerce and education, but a lot of the people there feel much more comfortable talking in the vehicular language of Tok Pidgin. I'm going to show you that we've been working in this coastal region along the Huon coast in Morobe province. Along this area, there's a vernacular language called Kala. It's spoken by people in six villages, which are not large enough to be featured on this map. So I'm going to show you a close-up of the area and give you a Kala speaker's view of the Kala speaking world. Okay, these are six coastal villages. Here you can see their names. We're going to be working, or the work that I'm going to be talking about here is primarily in this village called Kamiali. And if you ever get interested in this and want to find more information, you should also know that it's officially known on a lot of maps as Lababia. And our co-author, John Wagner, in his publications often refers to it as Kamuyali. Now, some of the variation in this place name may be due to there not being an official writing system for the language when we started these projects. And it's actually this lack of a writing system that brought us together. I'm going to give you a view of what life is like in Kamiali. This is Main Street. There are no cars here. There are no roads here. There's no electrical service. There's no telephone service. The only way into and out of the village is by boat. Here's a view of some typical homes. What I'd really like you to notice here is that almost every man-made structure that you can see in this photo was sourced or collected from the surrounding environment. Okay, these people lead pretty much a subsistence lifestyle. Gardening provides the bulk of their diet, and fishing is the almost exclusive source of the protein in their diet. And that's going to become important to me anyway a little bit later on. Well, our co-author, John Wagner, spent a year living in this village when he was doing his dissertation research. And during that time, he became very concerned that Kala was diminishing in its use. And in fact, this decline was so extreme in some of the villages that he feared that the language would not continue to exist. Another thing that John recognized while doing his work was there was a very strong link between the use of the language and an environmental conservation ethic. One of the stories that he shared with us was a talk from an elder who was describing gardening practices. The gardens of Kamiali are on a floodplain of a river, and this elder described that traditional practices would emphasize some level of respect for the environment, and he was concerned that the young adults were losing this respect for the environment. And his example was when young adults today clear an area for a new garden, they will take the trees, cut them down all the way to the edge of the river, exposing the riverbanks. Well, the traditional way would have been for the people to leave the trees in place right along the riverbank because the people understood that the fish and the other aquatic organisms that lived in the river needed the shade. They also understood that these trees would help to stabilize the riverbed itself and minimize damage from flooding that occasionally takes place. The reason that they thought that the kids or the young adults were not following these practices today was because of the loss of the Kala language. Many of this young adults are now speaking that vehicular language of Tok Pidgin, which does not contain words for the various species that would live there. But in the Kala language, there would be words for all of the species in the river, and then stories about how you would take care of your gardens and properly prepare your gardens would be passed down from generation to generation. So with the lack of Kala language, or with the Kala language dying out, there was also the loss of this traditional knowledge. Well, I'm going to shift gears a little bit now and tell you how I became involved with working in this village. My employer, Bishop Museum, became interested in the area because it is almost a pristine environment. There's only about 600 people that live in the village of Kamiali. There's never been any logging or mining there, so it looks like a biologist's wonderland, okay? But also some place that would be worthy of continuing to preserve in this relatively pristine condition. Now, I say that we have to put some effort forward on this because that specter of logging and mining is always there. Because despite living there near a subsistence lifestyle, these people do need money for medicine and for education. The average person at Kamiali gets malaria about twice a year. Education is not a free government service. And the way that other nearby communities have solved this need for money was to sell logging and mining rights to their lands. And this has often had tragic environmental and social consequences as outsiders come in there and start extracting resources. So one of my colleagues at the museum came up with what I think is a quite brilliant plan. It's very simple. The idea is that because we have a relatively pristine environment, that biologists would be interested in working in this area. And as the biologists are there, they're going to be spending money for room and board, paying for local field assistants to help them out, paying research fees. So this research is providing an income stream. And the community is very much aware that the success of this whole venture depends on them taking care of their environment. So this is intended to be a self-sustaining cycle. Well, I went down in 2008 to begin the marine conservation aspect of this project and quickly realized that the biggest challenge to this conservation research income cycle was fishing on coral reefs. Remember I told you earlier on that fish is the major source of dietary protein there. The concern is that if these people fish so hard that they're depleting their reef fishes, that the biologists, especially the marine biologists, aren't going to be interested in going to this area. So I quickly realized that my job was to work with the village to try to find an appropriate balance between marine conservation and the need for and the cultural value of marine exploitation. Okay. It's at this point that I got really excited about that message that John was putting out, that there seems to be this positive relationship between the use of Kala and an environmental conservation ethic. Okay. So I would like to give you just one quick example of how the Kala language could help me with my mission. We think that there are about 1,200 species of reef fish that live in the Kamiali area. Unfortunately, I only know their scientific names, and here's a list of some of them. And I think when you take a look at this, you can understand why these words would be overwhelming to the layperson. It would really benefit me to be able to present fish names in a way that was understood by the locals. I couldn't use the Tok Pidgin version because pretty much it didn't account for this this biodiversity. This is a list of just some of the 95 species of wrasse that we expect to find at Kamiali. And if there were a Tok Pidgin word, it would probably be the word for wrasse, not species of wrasse. Whereas in Kala, there would be names for all of these species. There would probably be names for different life stages of the species and perhaps even names for different sexes of the species. So I got all excited and quivering with anticipation. I called up John Wagner, explained to him what I wanted to do, asked him where I could find some Kala translators to help me produce all of my reports in the vernacular language, and this was his advice. Okay. John's concern was that there was not yet a standardized writing system for the language. Okay? And he was concerned that there would be errors introduced into the translations that I could generate at that time, and that those errors would be propagated. And I want to show you a local example of that right now. Here's a map of the Hawaiian Islands. This was produced in 1785, shortly after the first Europeans stepped foot in Hawaii. At that time, there was no writing system for the Hawaiian language. So the cartographer did the best he could to spell what he was hearing as the Hawaiian pronunciations for the island names. If you can't see them on the maps right there, I printed them out next to each of the islands, and compare that to how we spell the names of the islands today using the standard Hawaiian alphabet. Okay, there was a lot of differences there, and as I've gone back and looked over when I was writing down what I thought were the names of fish in this area, I can see John was right. There would have been a lot of errors introduced. Well, fortunately for me, John was already at work trying to get the language documented to come up with a standardized writing system. In 2006, he was down in the villages again, recording this transition from Kala to Talk Pidgin, and at that time he was also working with the villages to create the Kala Language Committee, which was consisted of representatives from all six of the Kala speaking villages. By 2009, I think it was, John and Christine started the Kala Language and Environmental Knowledge Project. The long-term goals of that project were to revitalize the Kala language in all six of the Kala-speaking villages, but fortunately for me, they also wanted to come up with a standardized writing system for the language. By 2010, John and Christine, their student Kara DeVolder, were down documenting the language. Christine reviewed all the sounds in the language and then went to the Kala Language Committee and presented some ideas about how they could represent their sounds with some symbols. In other words, they're working on an alphabet right now. It's the community that chose those symbols, and those have been in use ever since. So what I'm really trying to tell you right now is that as of 2010, there was an official, universally accepted writing system for the Kala language. And here that is. Here's the alphabet. There are 23 letters. There are 10 vowels, or about double what we have in the English language, which means we have about half of what exists in the English language. There is also another sound that's used in the dialect of two of the villages. The sounds that do not appear in English or in the Talk Pidgin languages are some of these vowels that are nasalized, and now I'm going to have to ask for Christine's backup if she would pronounce those for me.
Okay. I'll try to do it from here. I forgot. So the nasal A, E, O, and U. Which causes minimal pairs. So for example, the word for canoe is wa, and uncle is wa. So nasalization.
Thank you. There's also a neat story, I think, about the choice of the symbol that indicates these nasalized vowels. Christine presented a series of options to the village, or to the various communities, and they chose what I would call a tilde. They call it a titi, which is the Kala word for waves in the ocean. Okay? So again, this even the alphabet itself emphasizes a level of respect and a connection to the environment. Christine, I'm sorry, I'm going to call you up one more time. There's another letter. I call it the entail. It has a pronunciation that I'm not familiar with, so maybe you can help me. Thank you. And then another letter that I can deal with. There's an L in the Kala language. My English-speaking ears hear this as an R sound, but the true Kala speakers say that it is indeed an L. And Christine describes this sound to me as a flap sound. Okay, well, very good. So we've got an alphabet now. I'd like to show you how a Kala speaker uses pictures to represent the different sounds of the alphabet. And what I'd really like to emphasize here is that almost all of these pictures are from the natural environment. Okay, even these things that represent technology, for instance, here, and here are made from items collected from the surrounding environment. So a bundle of wood, a gardening tool made with a stick, a stone, and some vines, a paddle made from wood, and a fishing pole made from bamboo. OK? Okay. Now, contrast this with the way that today's American children's, what symbols they might associate with their alphabets, and I think you get a real sense of the differences between these two cultures and how much of an emphasis there is on the natural environment in the Kala language. Shortly after the alphabet was adopted, a Kala language dictionary was produced in 2012 by Christine and her student Cara, and John was involved in that too, right? Okay. It's really interesting to me because they're documenting a lot of environmental information here. These are names for things that are found in the natural environment. This also fulfilled one of the goals of the villages that they would like to record their traditional knowledge. Okay. So all this work by Christine and John and their student Cara paved the way for me to start publishing reports and other products in the Kala language that relate to marine conservation then. And I'm going to show you some examples right now. One of my big messages down in the village of Kamiali in terms of marine conservation is give a fish the chance to reproduce before it ends up on your dinner table. Okay? This gives each fish the chance to seed or contribute to the next generation, hopefully maintaining populations of fish for future generations of humans in the village. What I did was produce what I call a fish tape. This just has the size at maturity or the adult size of fishes listed there, but it features the Kala names as well, so people understand what it is that I'm talking about. Pictures of the fish, but also the Kala words. And I'm going to give you a view down a half of the tape so you can see what sort of different types of fish that we incorporated into this fish tape. This thing is flexible, it's waterproof. The idea is that a fisherman can just shove it in his pocket before he hops in the canoe and goes out fishing. If he catches a fish, he can lay it down on the measuring stick and determine whether that individual fish was mature or not. Some other things that I do, every year I get to go down, I produce a technical report summarizing the state of the fishery resources in the village. Now, this publication is produced on too short of a timeline for me to get a Kala translation, but I do include Kala names of fishes so that people can understand what it is that I'm talking about. And I think it's really interesting here that the Kala language does document the biological diversity in the area. The species up on top is a parrotfish, and it's got different color patterns for males and females. And hopefully you can see up here that there's a different word for each of those in the Kala language. Moving on past just fish names now, I also produced an informational poster that was designed to go along with that fish tape. It explains the rationale behind trying to catch adult-sized fish and provides suggestions on how people might alter their fishing practices such that they increase the chance of catching adult-sized fish. And then moving on from there, we were able to start finally producing full-scale reports that had Kala language translations. Here's an example of a school curriculum. The idea behind this one is that the school kids could go home, look at the fish catch that their parents made, start keeping a record of it and some of the measurements of the fish sizes, and over the years they would be able to judge whether their fishing practices in the village were sustainable or not. And over here on the right-hand side is the Kala language version. Just this year, I worked with the community to come up with a marine management plan that also has a Kala language version. One thing I want to point out is that you can probably imagine this, making the translations of the full document was a lot more complicated than just coming up with a list of fish names. We could sit down and put in a picture of a fish or hold a fish out to somebody and say, what's its name? What do you call this? How do we spell it? Okay, quite an easy process. In the publications, I had to try to write for the layperson, and I think that I succeeded for a native English speaker, but it was a lot more difficult trying to write scientific literature for a group of people who basically live a subsistence lifestyle. I had a hard time avoiding certain words and concepts that just didn't exist in their language. So we had to find a way to work around this, and it turned out I think we came up with a good solution. I would sit down with a native Kala speaker, and together we would come up with the talk pidgin version of what I wrote, okay, so the vehicular language in the area. This had a couple of advantages. One is that I'm only moderately conversant in talk pidgin, so anything that I would decide to write or say was necessarily simple. And the native Kala speaker was a lot more confident in his understanding of the Tok Pidgin version than he was with the English version. So the end result might not have been a literal translation of what I had written, but it made it a lot more accessible to the people in the villages down there. And I think it went a long way towards achieving my goal of promoting environmental or marine conservation awareness down there and what the area could do to help guarantee continued health of their environment. Well, it's a little bit too early for me to judge whether my marine conservation research has had the impact that I want. I simply need to spend a lot more time in the water. But I have heard some very good stories about the products that we've generated, the work that John and Christine and I have done together. One man told me how happy he was to be able to see the children of his village sitting down and learning the vernacular fish names. And that marine management plan that I just told you about was only distributed in the village on the 1st of February, less than basically 4 weeks ago. And shortly after I shared that with everybody, I was told how happy the people were that they could sit down and finally see something that was written in their language. Kind of wrapping it up right now, I do want to point out that I've showed you some of the things that I've made. John and Christine were also busy recording local stories. Here's one. They would publish this in Kala as well, the story of the shark. Again, I think it's interesting how much of the environment is emphasized in these stories and that they chose these sort of environmental stories as the way that they want to represent their language. And I think that working together as anthropologists and biologists has been very, very beneficial. We've increased the number of products that have been produced in the Kala language. That's increased its visibility. We've been able to cross-promote what it is that we do. I don't work in any of the other villages doing this marine research, but the Kala Language Committee is very much aware of what it is that I've been doing because I've been able, with John and Christine's help, to do these translations. And again, people that work with me might not be aware of what it is that John and Christine are doing without me having been involved in their project. So we've done, a very good job of cross-promoting our projects. The other benefit to us collaborating is that we've got a different circle of colleagues. And last year I was able to take an archaeologist down to Kamiali with me. One of the things that she likes to do is make these memory games to give out as gifts when she goes to a new place. And in the last version of her, this is the idea where you have a bunch of cards and you lay them face down and you try to turn over matching pairs and you get to keep the cards if you find the matching pair. And in her last version, she used Kala fish names in there. So I think it's really exciting to think about where new Kala language products might go as we bring more and more individuals who have their own unique perspective on research in this area when we bring them down to that region. Okay, that's all I have to say. Thank you all very much for listening, and I'd be happy to take questions now. And maybe if you have tough linguistic questions, I can bring Christine up here as a little bit of backup muscle. Thank you. Hi.
I really like your presentation. I really like what you're doing. In my work, I go back to very, very, very old Hawaiian literature to recover old Hawaiian plant names and to tie them to plant names of further in Polynesia. And I just wanted to recommend a book to you called Voices of Eden by Albert Schutz. And the reason why is he talks about the history of the Hawaiian language and we know these kinds of things have happened in all regions. And in particular, with respect to your map, and you said, well, these are mistakes, it may not be that cut and dry. I'm looking at those island names, and they may be a variation that is really important in the etymology of the words. And I can't go further into that right now because it's kind of controversial. For example, the missionaries decided Hawaiians couldn't tell between K and T or L and R, so they made a decision. And I think, well, things like that very often have really important variations that we can look at to sort out the puzzles. So I just kind of want to encourage you not to say unilaterally like it's wrong. It's a variation.
I appreciate that, because when we sit at Kamiali, and I often ask Christine this question, is how much is the way we see a language today that came up with the writing system, how much is that a function of the person who was working on the writing system and what they heard. So I can see a lot of, for instance, Tahitian words that there's just slight variation between L's and R's, for instance, Alua and Arua. Like how much of that is my, like somebody with my English ear hearing not the L flap, but an R. So I appreciate what you're saying. Voices of Eating. Okay, thank you. The question is about the paper doesn't last that long. It's such a humid tropical environment and the things eat the paper, it just kind of falls apart. I try to make, I print on high quality paper, number one, and I've seen that some of the things that I produced in 2008 are already falling apart. For the permanency, for instance, those fish tapes that I made were made on vinyl posters actually, probably the same sort of material that's used to make this poster down here, so it should last a lot longer. The other ones, in terms of the villages having access to that, because they're so remote, because they have no telephone service, no electrical service, there's no internet service, we post everything online, so theoretically people can continue to get access to it. But in terms of permanency of things in the village, it's the way it is. Sure. First of all, this is the first iteration of this talk, so I've already been asked by my employers, there's an international unit of the conservation of nature is coming here next year sometime, and I've been encouraged by my employers to give this talk there, which would be the group of biologists, so I'm not sure how it will be received, but certainly there's a recognition among biologists that there is a lot of information in these languages, and some of my colleagues that have worked down at Kamiali talk about the specific names for things, where sometimes even as people who think that we are very good naturalists and scientists and can see these variations, that the local community would have names for variation that we as outsiders have not even perceived. Sure.
So tell us what we can do to help you out, to collect data for you
I think documenting those things, and it depends on the avenue of research that somebody's taking to. I can't give a general answer to that question because different people do different sorts of things. For instance, I'm going down to New Guinea again on Saturday, and I'm taking a person who does molecular biology with me, and they're going to just collect the fins of fishes, and that's enough for them to do the work that they need to do. They just need to know what name was assigned to it at that time and where it came from. On the other hand, somebody that was a true museum worker that was concerned about taxonomy would need this properly pressed and prepared plant specimen, hopefully showing the flowering structures and things like that. So my recommendation would be, if you are going to a place where you think you can contribute something valuable, talk to people that might be interested in what it is that you would be able to bring back, and they can give you some specific instructions on what to do. And in particular, images are easy to bring back, but in some parts of the world, it's very hard to get specimens out of a country, for instance. And that's one thing that, that we deal with when we're down there. We try to work only within country when we're doing some of the work. So it's one of those, I can't give you a general all-purpose answer. It would be more of a, locate the person that would probably most benefit from what it is that you're doing, and they can provide that information. Okay. All right. Thank you very much.